Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schutt, here with my buddy Dave Cook. Dave, how are you doing today, man?
I am doing great, man. I'm so excited to be on Robots and Red Tape and to be talking today.
I really appreciate you, man. I know how busy you are. We were just talking about it a little bit before we started. And I appreciate you making time for this, man. If you don't mind, Dave, for everybody that's listening, do you mind telling folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here?
Sure. The how I got here always a good story. Particularly how I got here and the things that I think we'll be talking about today. I am probably what you would call a data entrepreneur at heart, which is really somebody that looks to help others find and uncover truth and meaning in data. I have a pretty extensive career. Almost all of my time has been spent in government. A lot of time in law enforcement, intelligence, and defense, and really kind of working on different things related to advanced analytics. And probably over the last 15 years or so, have been pretty heavily involved with AI and machine learning. So, I kind of have had this really good fortune of being able to ride a couple of different waves, so to speak. And so, back in this will tell you how old I am. Back in the mid 90s, I was in grad school at Carnegie Mellon back in Pittsburgh. And at that time, the real big focus was on at least. At my school was on, analytics and geospatial, particularly related to law enforcement. That led me to a career in law enforcement. It was great. I found that at the time, there was this, push towards advanced analytics. And, the challenge that we often had was we had data and we had tech, but we didn't quite have the ability always to leverage it exactly the way that we wanted. And so I went into geospatial. I got to, go into law enforcement and spend time with data. They had more than they could ever, give me to work with. So it was great. Moved from there into another place in Lincoln Social Network Analysis, kind of looking at the relationships among individuals and people. And all the things that we really wanted to do, I was starting to find because cloud came along, network and storage, things like that. And so we started to really have all of the infrastructure that allowed us to really take advantage of and exploit the data. And that's really where we got into, where I think I got into kind of data entrepreneurship. Back in 2013, I started my own company mainly because it's a pretty funny story. Mainly because I was complaining about a lot of, I was doing some work with a local government agency, and really where I was running into problems, I was just complaining about the fact to my dad that I really didn't have the tools that I wanted. And so finally, I think he just got annoyed with me, and it's like, either I didn't raise a complainer, so either build the tools that you don't have, or stop complaining. Something to that effect. It was a little bit more terse, but I was like, well, the man's got a point. So I started my own company, did that for a few years. And back in 2017, there was a real push towards using AI and machine learning within the government sphere, particularly in defense, which later moved more into the intelligence community. And I've been doing that ever since. Data engineering, model dev, how do we deploy at scale, cloud caught up, but I always kind of go back to data. And I think that has really kind of driven me, kind of understanding data, ways in which we can use data, ways in which we can manage risk with data. All of those things have been really important. And I think that's kind of as I've stuck to data, and how we can use it and ways we can use it effectively, I think that kind of brought me here.
That's fantastic, man. I really appreciate that. I love your story about starting your own company because essentially you wanted tools and just kind of complain, it and just go out and build it myself, or it's just not going to happen, right?
And that's I think that one of the great things that I've seen is the kind of the rise of builders, and people who really the people who really have access now to tools that I'm a bit envious of. I didn't quite have when I was back in grad school. I really am amazed at the a level of tools that you can have in terms of Python or R, or are new kinds of, your ability to code, whether it's in, JavaScript or anything else that, just, or Julia as a good example, which is a new language that I've been working with. It's amazing, what you're able to do and the access to data, the access to tools, the ability to kind of become your own entrepreneur, just, using open source. It's incredible. And it's really, kind of led me towards, I think, the spirit of giving back to a lot of the community that I work in. I live and work in DC. My wife and I are here in Georgetown. And I think that working with the data science DC community has been kind of one of the best things I've been able to do over the past few years. I really have loved that.
Dude, that's fantastic, man. And I think I read that here in the DC area, because I'm in Northern Virginia. I believe that I read that we have the second largest AI and data workforce and population in the country here, behind, I think it's behind behind Silicon Valley. Do you know if that's right?
That sounds about right. I think so. I think that you find a lot of folks really love the challenge of working with big data, and that's what government is. I mean, if government has, I think, big data should be in every government agency's mission statement because they're often collecting data in order to be able to deliver services more efficiently, to be able to identify people that are trying to do us harm, to be able to, dispense things like good health care. When we have a pandemic, government's really able to leverage data, I think, in a way that nobody else really can. Now, they don't do it. Government doesn't do everything perfectly. But the ability to gather data, I think government excels at. And to that degree, people who are really have an appetite for like wanting to dig in and be mission focused, this is a great area. So I wouldn't be surprised in the least if we have a huge population of data scientists, data engineers, AI ML engineers.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. And I think that the government is around, every government agency should have big data involved and a big data component. I think that the government's getting there, especially when you look at the CDAO mandate and the requirement to have a chief data and analytics officer in every agency. And I mean, but you look at folks like, CMS has, I think they have one of the largest databases of information in the world. When you start looking at looking for healthcare fraud, managing inefficiencies, and looking to find ways to deliver healthcare more efficiently, that's a huge, even if you save half a percentage point or 1 point of a budget, when you're managing a $2 trillion budget, that's huge, huge,
Yep.
huge, huge money, right?
Yeah,
It's
it's I would say, yeah, it's like I don't know whether that was LBJ or Nixon. It was like, a million here, a million there, and all of a sudden you're talking real money. And that's the truth. I mean, I've seen a good friend of mine is the CFO at GAO. And I love the mission of GAO just because their capacity to use good analytical tools to find true savings for the government to say like this is the stuff that we're going to do now. Maybe it's dangerous to wade into political waters. We've got Elon and Vivek and the new DOGE, which is going to be interesting. But you can bet your bottom dollar that they are going to be using lots of analytical tools to try and go in and figure out where are the inefficiencies and where can we save money, and they exist. I love government. It's been my whole life, to be fair, but at the same time, there are inefficiencies, and
Course.
if that's going to be the charge, then go forth and let's see what you can do.
Yeah, I think that the inefficiencies that you're talking about, because absolutely they exist. I mean, but anytime you start doing anything at scale, inefficiency
Totally.
is going to come in, right? And I think the U.S. government's the largest employer in the world. I don't know that for a fact, but it feels right. When you start talking about the millions of people that, like not even counting contractors, right? Just GS folks, and there's so many people, and the mission is so vast, so broad, and so complex. That of course there's going to be inefficiencies and there's going to be redundancies. And I mean, I've heard that there's a game that folks that work for USDA play, which is, does USDA do it or not? Because the USDA is so, I mean, they're huge and they're wide reaching. And I mean, I know that's more civilian side, but I feel like that's safer considering some of the places you've worked in the past.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I would say this. I mean, I think sometimes the inefficiency is the important thing, you know, and that's and you know, particularly with AI and machine learning and deep learning. I had a good friend who you know, kind of one of the folks I really admire in this business, who just made the point. It's like, you know, there is time spent doing, you know, regular data science, and then there's deep learning time. And, you know, that's a whole different ball of wax, because you can spend hours, days doing stuff, trying to get better performance out of something, and you may or may not get there. And, you know, the inefficiencies certainly exist when you're doing AI and machine learning. You can try and do it, I think, in you know, which is really kind of one of my newer approaches, is what I call lean AI ML. And it's, how can I do as much as possible with as minimal, with the least amount of data possible? So what can I do in order to optimize performance by using the minimal amount of data, because that can often be such a big expense. But you make learnings from, you know, the ways in which you deploy. And you know, you don't get it right the first time. Maybe you do, you may not, but that's what, you know, test and evaluation is for. I mean, you know, there's the thought around software is never really done. AI and machine learning is definitely never done, and good data is never done. You know, you have to constantly be, you know, mindful about it, and you put in processes in order to kind of get slimmer and slimmer. And you know, you can, you know, do the things that you want to do. But yeah, sometimes the it's not, I'd hate to say it's not waste. It's just, it is just not, it's suboptimal. Is maybe the best way to say it. It's like, it's suboptimal. Like, we're not getting the best result that we could get. So what do we do different? And getting there is tough, and getting there in government's tough. I mean, I've been involved in programs where, you know, we didn't do it right the first time. I remember, you know, you and I were talking before, and I remember in one of my before we started here, one of my interviews for a job, many a few jobs ago, at least. You know, and they asked, like, what's one of the biggest mistakes you know, made? Like, when tell me about your biggest failure. And I actually said, I was like, you know, there's a case where there was a way in which we were curating training data, which we can talk about in a bit with something that I've had been working on. But there was a way in which we were curating training data, and a colonel said, you know, I just need, I have a goal. This is my goal. And I was like, yes, sir, got it. We're going to go after that. Now, what I did not do, and it was my failure, was to not tell them that the way in which we were going to get there was to kind of slim down the way in which we ensure quality within the way in which we were creating the data. And, you know, we just didn't take the processes the way that we should have done. You know, it was kind of what we call one judgment, as opposed to like multiple judgments, which together creates a better quality in training data. And so, you know, we created all this data, we got through his target, and then it turns out like the model performance was horrible, you know. And you know, it's like, what the heck is going on? Like, why is this the case? You know, we're spending all this money. And you know, I had to own up and say, like, listen, sir, you know, this is on me. I That's not the way to do it. This is the way to do it, you know. And sometimes I like to tell entrepreneurs that I've worked with and I mentor now, I was like, listen, you know, you have to remember that you are not just a, you know, to really be there long term and to help and to make a difference, you are not just a contractor, you are a partner. And if they know how to do it, they would do it, but they don't. So they're hiring you to do it. And so you owe it to them to be straight up as possible. And you have to have this attitude of like, why not us? You know, it's like, well, they got to know better. It's like, no, they don't. If they did, they'd be doing it. I was like, you have to, you know. I never was so proud when I had somebody who was like almost a little intimidated by, you know, uniforms and you know, bars on and stars on people's collars. And I was like, listen, you know how to do this better than anybody else. Just take that marker and go up there and tell them. I was like, it's gonna be fine, you know. And if you get it wrong, I don't care. I was like, but you have that confidence, and that's one of the most rewarding things about working in government, is you really get to make a difference.
Absolutely. And I love what you said about partnership and instead of contracting, right? I've always viewed, we know we've talked about it. I have a very varied background, and I do a, like just like you, I do a lot of different things right now, and I'm involved in a lot of different projects and programs. But my background and how I got my start professionally in this government contracting space was in the recruiting space and the staff augmentation space, right? And I know first that you have talked to a lot of folks that do what I do, and I'm sure a lot of people reach out to you and have over the years, right? It's a very competitive industry, and the barrier to entry is pretty low. But what I always tell people is, if you're, is if you are looking for a resume shop or a body shop that's just gonna you're gonna give me a position description and you want us to just throw people at you and hope that we're right, like that's not what we do, but if you want to have a serious conversation about understanding, your requirements, understanding your pipeline, understanding not just what you have now, but what's coming up in the future, understand the types of people that you're looking for, getting a real understanding of your processes and how we can come in and augment what you're doing and do it better and faster than you how you're doing it presently. Well, do that, right? And the best client relationships I've ever had have been the ones that buy into that and understand the value that we bring to the table and understand that, yes, a lot of folks look at the recruiting. I've always compared it to like people will say we're the used car salesman of the professional world, right? Whereas just a lot of folks have that reputation. But at the end of the day, we provide an incredible amount of value for our clients, the folks that we work with, and we're able to help, especially like, companies that are like, 50 to, 300 people bridge a gap because especially as you start working in the spaces that you walk in and you've worked in, once you exhaust your immediate network, figuring out how to go out and get highly skilled people in the data space that are cleared, two top secret and above top secret is very, 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 very difficult, right? Especially when you start looking at how like quick turnarounds, like maybe task order gets released and you need four or five people really quickly. Maybe how do you continue to backfill when you bid people on rate, off of rates that you have presently on people on what you're paying people, but then something like inflation over the last 4 years happens, and then all of a sudden you can no longer like the market no longer supports and bears the rate that you're doing. How do we come up with solutions for that? And how do we get ahead of that? How do you understand the market and understand pricing in the marketplace? Because you can go out and pull data, but unless you're talking to people also and understanding. Like it's, it just becomes much, much more difficult. And so, and that's, and breaking, and having the confidence to telling somebody that's built a company that for, 300, 400, 500 people that, know you're wrong. This is how you need to do it. I mean, it's difficult. It takes a lot, but also, and I think this is the important part is that's where true partnership comes in. It's like true partnership is telling people the truth, even if they don't want to hear it, even if it's detrimental to yourself and detrimental to what you're doing. You have to tell them where it is, and exactly what you said, Dave, is own up to it and say, "Hey, this is on me, right? I made a mistake," or what have you. So.
I've led a couple of teams, over the past few years, and I'm mentoring a lot of folks, which I don't know that I would consider myself a mentor because I probably learned as much from them as they did from me. But I don't know whether it's just because I'm older or whatever. But they kind of looked at me that way. But I do really I enjoy it, and I also think you hit on a really good point. Something that I've focused on the last few years has been, listen, if you don't say no to things, then your yeses don't mean anything. And you have to be very clear about that. And I also, I think it's one of the Steve Jobs quotes about, I say, just about the fact that he said no to so many things before he said yes to anything, and it's like, I do get, to be fair, get a lot of, things about, you're interested in doing this or interested in doing that. And I'll always listen, but, I'm usually straight up at the end of the conversation. I'll be like, no, I don't think I'm the right person. But guess what? I know somebody that is, and I will connect you with them. I think you pay it forward that way. But to me, working with clients, I say no a lot, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't think that's the right thing to do. I have found, the ability to just be, maybe it's freeing to be in my 50s. But just to be able to say, like, this is who I am, this is what I do. And I'm pretty unfiltered, not in a bad way. Just I'm like, listen, I don't think that's a good idea, and here's the five reasons why. Because at the same time, when I say that's a fantastic idea, That's the thing that people they perk up, and so I found that that's been much more impactful.
Yeah, and I love what you said, that if you say yes to everything, if you say yes to everything, your no's don't mean anything. I think that's how you said it, right?
You have to say no to things in order to for your yeses to mean something. Yeah.
That's it. It's the other way around. My apologies. I love that though, and I
Yours
think.
was better, by the way.
Hey man, so people ask me what I do for a living, Dave. I say I talk. I
It
professionally talk, is most of what I do. And no, but I you're absolutely right though. And I think that, especially as you start looking at, moving into higher level roles or working at a higher level, or in any vertical, right? Because I'm in, like, for me, I'm in healthcare, I'm in GovCon, I'm still in staffing a little bit, I'm still doing a bunch of that work. I have this, I have an event, I have an event I run too, an event series I'm running. All of them are very, very different, and trying to figure out which one to do when and how to focus on them and is a lot. But the only way I'm like, then you have to learn how to build systems underneath, and then you're managing people and mentoring people. Because if when you you know a book that I read a number of years ago about entrepreneurship is called Built to Sell. It's a little, like, I'm not sure if you know it, but it's like a little 110 page book. And what it really reiterated was, and what I learned from it and took from it, was that business, like, when you go to sell a business, you're selling a system that you've built, you're selling processes, right? As opposed to, so how do you focus on one thing, become known for one thing? Because when you do everything, you do nothing, right? Just like when everybody's responsible for it, nobody's responsible for it, right? You need to know specifically who's in charge of getting the deliverable. But then how do you go from, a solopreneur, just you or just me doing that, to a business that can actually be sustained without you? Because I think one of the most important things is, like, I'm always looking to remove myself from the equation. If you don't need me to do something anymore, I am here for it, right? Like, I don't necessarily want to, I don't want to be super, super involved in every granular detail and everything. I want to build the system and walk away, and then just go look at the system, like, quarterly, and make sure it's still operating, and just keep my finger on the pulse. And if we need to change some pieces or change some processes or change some workflows, we can do that. Or implement new technology, we can do that. But I'm always looking to automate myself out of jobs.
Exactly. I mean, I am the same way. Listen, when I spend so much time in data, I love a good, unstructured data lake, full of stuff that I just got to dig into. But I will say my proudest moments have been when I have been able to step back because I've empowered other team members in order to be able to do the work that I used to do. I've helped them kind of figure out how to do it. Far prouder of that than I've been just in some of the things that I've managed to accomplish. And scaling up, I mean, has been as you try and turn a business into something bigger and bigger and get beyond just being you, the single point of failure. Those are the biggest moments that are worthwhile is when you see it. And then, you can see kind of that transformation in the folks that you brought on. And I've been lucky. That's been, I mean, probably like a lot of folks, I mean, my personal life and my business life tend to blend. And of the projects that I've done over the past year, I started, this year a nonprofit. And that's one where, my wife actually and I have done it together. That's not how it started, by any stretch. It was by no means something where I was like, oh great, I'm just going to pass off work to her. It truly turned into something, but that's not how we intended it to happen. And so, I feel incredibly lucky that kind of thing has happened because, I've been able to have her be more involved, and it's kind of nice when that kind of stuff works out.
Absolutely, man. And so, I mean, I was about to go there anyway, but can you tell folks about the Training Data Project, kind of what it is and why you started it?
Sure. I mean, I love AI training data. It's kind of, the The thing that I think that it's one of the things that matters the most. It is like the jet fuel of AI. It's the thing that really moves it forward. And I always like to say nothing moves in AI ML without training data. It can be the most important thing that you do right. And so I was a friend of mine and I had spotted a SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research Grant, last year, and started to work on it. And as we were kind of, batting around ideas about it, and we were scrambling to do the proposal, as fast as we could. And one night I was sitting at dinner with my wife, and it just I kind of threw out this idea, like somebody really needs to do. I was talking through this idea that I had about what we were going to propose, and it's like somebody really needs to do like a nonprofit around this. I feel like there's a problem with the fact that the way in which we evaluate the way training data and what we call trust scores, so this is good data or not good data, and but everybody does it differently. Every and all of it are all of those trust scores are really the property of proprietary software. There's no common metric that we can all agree on that is good. There's no, for lack of a better term, objective truth that says, this is the way in which training data should be. It should be as representative as possible, but when you're a government person and you're trying to make a purchasing decision about, I trust this data over this data, do I have a good way to say one is better than the other? And you don't. And so I was like, somebody needs to stand like in the middle of this. And there should be like, it has to be like somebody that everybody could trust because they don't have a vested interest in selling a platform. And so there you go. I said, I think a nonprofit would be really good. And she was like, that's a great idea. My wife Nomi said, like, that's a fantastic idea. Nomi, by the way, is not, I shouldn't say she's not a data person. She's actually really good at data. I just don't think she knew it. So she's an interior designer. So I have a beautiful house. I freely admit I had nothing to do with it. The nonetheless, so she was like, that's a great idea. You should write it down. And so I did. I went upstairs and I churned out like 5 pages worth of context and or content, and it was all like the business case on like why this is a good idea. And I took it down to her the next day, and I was like, "What do you think?" And she was like, "It's brilliant, and you have to do it. I don't know anybody that cares about this like you do." And so from there, we started the training data project. I kind of kicked it off and came up with all the content, and she got involved because I was like, "Well, I need a website." And so I hired somebody to do it who will remain nameless, but it's a bigger company that does this kind of stuff. And they came back with something, and this website was horrible. I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. I cannot believe it. I was just like, it was so bad. I mean, it was just like
Offline, I want to know who
the it's
that
truly terrible. And I was like,
is,
I
so
can't believe like you guys are like a name brand with this. You guys should do this right. And they weren't responsive or anything like that. And so then she was like, I think I can do a better job. I was like, great. I was like, I here's a couple concepts, run with it. I would love that. And she comes back and it was fantastic. It's not a shameless plug, but it's only because her work is really that good. Go to trainingdataproject.org and you will see. I mean, she really did like a wonderful job with it. And so from there, what I started to really, find as we were getting more momentum and I started, generating more content. We were, doing more at events. So I speak usually about once a month at an event. We're starting to get a lot more interest in the things that we're doing. And the Training Data Project really is a couple of different things, but we're really focused on three, which is good standards to promote interoperability within training data, open source tools provided free to the public in order to be able to evaluate training data quality, and then just capturing best practices and kind of making that conversation happen around training data because there's nothing glamorous about training data. I mean, it is the sewer pipes and the infrastructure of AI and ML, but you get it wrong and everything else goes bad. And so,
Your foundation.
probably one of the, one of the best things that's happened, over the, I think since we started this, since, almost now we're at the end of the year or our first year, has been we've been able to really work together and completely trust her in her ability to say, like, I don't think this works, or She's sometimes the criticism's a little tough to hear, but I've gone through a presentation and she's like, yeah, that's good. And so, but she said, here's how you can make it better. She's restructured my presentations, done my, helped me do my PowerPoints and make them, really kind of, be more impactful. So that's been one of the best things about this is really I have a huge respect for her and her ability to kind of pivot and help me get the message out. And I can tell that she really, I really feel like she cares about it as well. And and it's something that's really taken off. I mean, right now we are really getting a lot of interest in, I get a lot of folks asking for advice about training data and ways in which they can improve their tooling or things that they want to do on their software platform. I've met so many good people that are trying to do it right. So that's kind of been the a real highlight of the past year. And it's a passion project. I love it. I'm working on a book chapter and a book on it right now. So
Amazing. And for folks that don't understand and don't know, because they're trying to educate people here, can you explain, like, really simple at a fundamental level, like, what is training data and why it's important and why it is like the sewers and the pipes and the foundation of any good AI or ML, any good AI or ML deployment?
absolutely. So training data is it is the fuel of AI and ML. And by that I mean machines don't do things that unless we teach them how to do it. And so whether you're talking about a model that I don't want to say products, but if you think about you've got your own personal assistant and you have to read off a set of words in order for it to understand your voice and understand how you're speaking, that's providing training data to it. Or it's the training data could be a representation of the real world. So if you think about a car that's self-driving, in order for it to be able to understand what a stop sign or another obstacle or another car looks like, it has to have been taught what those things look like, at least general representations of it, and as many variations as possible. And so you teach the machine what to look for. That becomes the model. You train the model, and then the model is able to adapt to what actually happens in the real world. So it kind of, you teach it, you train it, and when you train it, it's able to then be deployed into the world and actually be able to operate. And so you see this a lot of times in cases where you see these, nice boxes or circles about identifying objects on video, or you see it when, something is able to understand when you're calling, and somebody answers it, it's a machine answering and it asks you to say a certain phrase. It will understand what it is because it's trained to understand the way in which a human voice sounds and the words that you're making. And so training data is so important because if you get it wrong, then it's not going to allow your model to be optimal in terms of its performance. Where it can really go wrong is in places and things that I work in, like defense and intelligence, where it has an impact on the model, because you've got the data, you're going to curate the data. So you have to do what we call label the data. And labeling means you're just telling the, you're kind of identifying the objects in it. So if I'm labeling a photo and I've got different tanks in it and I'm labeling these tanks. Well, if I label, if the labels aren't of high quality and they don't, just really capture the tank, then when I'm training the model and I'm deploying it to go look for tanks and it finds it gets something wrong, then you're going to have all kinds of bad consequences. And so AI is really a pipeline. And so I go from the data all the way through to the training data, to the models, to the deployment, and to putting it out in the field. So if I get this part wrong on the training data side and I don't do high quality training data, I don't make it work well for the model, I get inject a bunch of errors into it, then it's not going to perform well throughout the entire process. And it really introduces a lot of risk into your AI pipeline. And so you have to have a lot of control over the quality of the data that you're creating. It's like the, you don't want to put, You don't want to put, alcohol into your gas tank. You want to put gasoline, because if you put, alcohol in there, it's just not going to perform well, or it's not going to run at all. And so it's something that you always have to be very careful about, the kind of data and the fuel that you're putting into AI. That's why it's so important. I often like to say bad data is worse than no data.
Okay.
And so,
Makes
it's,
sense.
we always worry that we have no data, but bad data is going to be worse, because it will, have downstream effects across your entire AI pipeline.
Absolutely. And I would assume, if in just running with your example of, self-driving cars, for instance, if the data was, tagged improperly, it would assume that all, say, for instance, stop signs were yield signs. Correct, something like that, or it wouldn't have, because you literally taught it the wrong thing. And so, as you look at the world of training data now, first, do most companies, like, or organizations in the government's case, just go out and buy data sets, first? And second, how much variable, like, how variable is the quality? And also, especially, with the areas that you work in, how do you ensure that you have a secure, you think, I think of like a chain of custody, right? When you start talking about processing evidence, how do you ensure that there's a chain of custody from, for the data set, to ensure that, bad actors are not inserting, inserting poison pills into data that the, US government is buying?
That's a good question, and you're asking really about, how to, what, how do you make sure that you have good quality within the data? What do you do to, and what do you do to prevent it? So the first thing is that the government, in most of the cases that I have seen, and I've been involved with them as well, full transparency, they usually are working with private sector companies in order to be able to either provide a platform or capability to label the data, and they can provide people to be able to do it. The company can, or they can use government folks as well. And usually, where I see that it's successful is you get somewhat of a combination, like a good mix between the two. I'm an operations research guy as well, and so for me, it's I'm always like looking for a good mix problem. And so, how do I get that proper, balance of, people who are good subject matter experts in the kinds of data that we're working with, along with people who may have no expertise in data, but are able to follow really good instructions. And that's one of the things that's really important about quality, and how you kind of ensure quality in it. Because, there's often this belief, and I see this in myself as well. Any good data scientist will admit this, that and any AI ML engineer, there's this belief that somehow, because, I'm an expert in X, Y, or Z. During COVID, I went back and got a master's in geospatial AI, and often mainly because I unlearned a lot of bad habits that I had because I worked in geo for so long. Nonetheless, am I the person that should curate my own training data, in order to train my own models? Because I know geospatial, I'm really good with different kinds of imagery and video. Should I be the person that curates my own training data so I can train my model, so then I can deploy it out into the field? And the answer is no. I am probably my worst person to do it, because I have lots of bias about what I think looks right, and I don't necessarily want that. I often would use crowdsourcing. That's what labeling companies often do, because you can have this good combination of people who don't know much about a use case. But if you provide them good, clear instructions on how to do it, and you provide them good training on how to do it, you're actually going to get better results. And it's kind of this, this beauty of crowdsourcing and labeling. So, to give you another example, you have a cow, and you have a farmer, and you have 100 people. Now, if you ask the farmer what the cow weighs, and you ask the 100 people what the cow weighs, if you bring together the 100 people's answer and you bring together the farmer's answer, those 100 people are going to be more accurate. That's just the beauty of crowdsourcing, is that if you get multiple, kind of judgments on something, and you actually bring them together and kind of harmonize them, you're going to get a better result. And so oftentimes what government agencies are doing is having that mix of, people who are not very familiar with a data type, like imagery or video or text, and then at the same time, you have a subject matter expert that may follow up and say, that judgment actually is good, or it's not good, or something to that effect. And so you bring subject matter experts and government folks to get or private sector folks together in order to curate the data. But the things that really ensure quality within it, there are a couple of things. I always ask people whenever I've been working on like trying to help them figure out. A lot of times when people come to Training Data Project, they'll they're looking for help on what should I think about? I'm thinking I got an AI initiative. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and I'm wondering about my, what are the things that I need to watch out for? And I usually first thing I ask is like, so what's your training data strategy? Like, how are you going to do this? And sometimes it's, well, I'm going to get some data, I'll, have it labeled, and then I'll train the model, and then I'm done. I was like, well, if the data is supposed to be representative of the world's always changing. Your data is going to have to, that's a constant pipeline. You need to plan on having refresh because those models are going to get brittle, they're going to get fatigued, and they're not going to work anymore. So then I was like, after we kind of get through that conversation, I was like, so let's think next about like, what does your data look like? What is your ontology? So what problems are you trying to solve? And what does success look like? Those are the three questions I usually ask, and that gets me most of what I need to know. And from there, as we start to talk through success and I start to understand their ontology, the things that they're looking to do, that's where I can start to develop good guidelines that will say, as we're going to label this data, this is how we're going to build instructions, which are usually written the way like a 5-year-old. If you're thinking about talking to a 5-year-old or a Labrador Retriever, it's kind of the same concept. That's how you want to write labeling instructions. That simple, with lots of representations. That ensures consistency. The second thing is quality control measures, and that can be randomized test questions, things that allow people to keep their acuity up as they're labeling the data. You can have other standards associated with it that make sure that if somebody does too many errors, those don't go into the data set and they fail too many questions and they basically get dropped out. And then you have kind of calibration and feedback. The way in which you can prevent that thing that you're talking about, data poisoning, is really by sometimes using like a red teaming approach. Where you actually have you inject errors into the data sets as people are labeling it. So you have kind of a counterexample in order to have models to make sure you see how people perform relative to that. It's like you're challenging somebody to make a mistake. And that's a good way sometimes also to work. But there's a variety of different other quality controls, but you need to have them there in order to have multiple judgments, to have test questions to keep people's acuity up. Those are all things that are really going to make a difference.
Absolutely. And from what I understand, labeling in and of itself is an incredibly tedious job. And there's only so much you can do it at one time. And a lot of these larger labeling companies have massive 1099 workforces that they work with that people do it on like as a side job as a second, like not mainly, I would assume not as a main source of income, just because there's only a couple of, you can only do it for a couple hours a day and there's a lot that goes into it. And I would, and I don't know where the performance fall off is, and I would assume that would change person by person, but
It's generally pretty common that, and you bring up a good point that, it is tedious work. And frankly, there's a great book written by a woman named Mary Grace who talked called Ghost Work, which is the idea that essentially, these folks who really do a lot of this AI curation are invisible. Which is tragic and a shame, and it should not be that way. That's the other thing that we're really focused on at Training Data Project, is that it is tedious, and people do tend to fall off after a certain period of time. So, when you're labeling data, and that's literally like drawing boxes on an image or on video or labeling text, or if you are working in a foreign language. When you have that specialty, if you're doing Chinese or Russian or whatever, and you're translating, it's a repetitive task over and over again. It's like a new industrial age of data. However, it's cognitive work, it's computational work, and it requires a real diligence and skill. And so, oftentimes what you see is having to, do things in order to keep people awake and alert and making sure that they're, and as they work, that they have enough variety in their tasks that we're able to, get good performance out of them. I will say I really feel like it's heavily underappreciated. Listen, it's not anybody's probably idea of a full-time career. I'm realistic about that. But I do think that, one of my goals personally is that it becomes a gateway for people to maybe who are interested in AI. I've done labeling, truth be told, I wanted to have integrity about TDP, about starting off the training data project. So the money that I had to pay for the website and everything like that, I actually went out and labeled data in order to pay for it. Because I felt like, that at least all that money, that I earned in order to kind of get the website set up, that came from labeling data. Just because, I think it is a good opportunity for people to become a good geospatial analyst, to become, a full motion video analyst, to become a text analyst, to become a good data engineer or an AI ML engineer. You do not have to do it forever. And I find that, it's a real gap sometimes that people don't understand the data that powers the machine learning models that they have. They really need to have a better understanding of how it gets curated and the ways in which it happens.
No, that makes a lot of sense because then you have a better understanding of the full life cycle, right? If you don't understand as you made the point, how important training data is and how important making sure that it's tagged properly and set up properly. If you don't understand that piece of it, I feel like you are missing a huge part of the AI life cycle or the data life cycle as it relates to building these higher level models on top of it. If you don't understand the foundation, you can build a really pretty house, but it's going to fall over, right?
100%. Yeah, and I've seen on some of the programs I worked on at DoD and within the Intel community, and then other use cases as well, where people have moved up. Some of the best companies that I've seen have been able to help people move up in getting more training, and getting better training. It's a great opportunity sometimes for people who have disabilities, or are differently able, the neurodiverse can actually be quite good at labeling data. There's a company in the DC area that works, their workforce is primarily neurodiverse individuals. I think it's wonderful, because those are folks that do fantastic work, do a great job, and I really, just see this as a way in which, we have people who sometimes are starving for work, and there's so many of them throughout the country there, because this is something you can do remote. It's something you can do from home sometimes, unless you're working in a classified space, you have to work there. But then guess what? That gets some people, who may not have, thought about getting a clearance. All of a sudden they're labeling data on the high side, and now they do have a clearance, and this is an avenue for them to, pursue another job. Maybe in that area as well. Everybody who wants a job should have a job. I really, just feel that in my heart.
I agree, and I think that I love, there's somebody I should introduce you to as a side note, but I mean, with the level of tedium that is involved in it, or the monotony that's involved in it, is this something that we can automate, or do we automate parts of it, or is there danger if we do automate it and create if the data that is used to automate tagging, if that's not right, maybe is it, would that have like a more negative effects down the road?
Yeah, so you bring up two good things. I hear this quite a bit. Is the first is really the idea that we have machine learning assisted labeling, and so the machine does the first pass, and then from there, humans kind of come in on the back end. I am definitely not a proponent of the idea of just letting, machines go label everything. And when I say machines, I mean machine learning models. Because, though that can have potential for errors, and those will propagate exponentially. And so you can end up with a lot of bad data that you can't do a lot of things with. And so there's always kind of this balance of you're striking between it's kind of, I guess I would call it an adaptive or iterative approach to letting machine learning models label some data, and then having humans come in and review and correct. One of the programs I worked on, we did worked on that with video. And so if you think about video, for example, video is a prime candidate for automation because if I can, if I had to label every single frame of a full motion video, like, 30 clips, and I've got to go in and draw a box for an object on everything, that's a horrible waste of time. But if I can just, draw a box on one and click through, and as long as I've got a model that can maintain persistence on that object, then I'm able to really automate the workflow. So those things are actually really good, and there are ways in which you can, some of the things we talked about already about ensuring quality on those. The second is synthetic data. And synthetic data is basically you use things like GANs, generative adversarial networks, to generate fake data from real data. Some people swear by it. I generally am not quite the believer in synthetic data because that can go also really wrong really quick. That's it. Sometimes it does tend to have, we just it, so you just don't quite see the performance out of it. Where synthetic data is really good is in sparse environments. So if I don't have a lot of good representations of, tanks covered by, certain things in the desert. And so I'm going to really struggle to find like those, 100 examples of a tank in the desert, at this angle with this kind of sun, like beaming down on it. Right. Then I would use synthetic data for it. But generally speaking, real world's always going to be better because that's what we all live in. It's human machine teaming. And so if we want the machines to help us, then we need to teach it how to interact with the real world and not the fake world. And so there are people, you can certainly make the argument there are efficiencies to be gained. I'm a little dubious about them. I think we'll get there eventually, but I haven't quite seen it yet.
Yeah, I think, but honestly, we're early days on a lot of this, right? And I mean, I know it's been going on for a while, but I
Yeah,
think
we're,
real early.
yeah, we are. I mean, the National Security Memo on AI, the unclassified version, came out back on October 24th. Really a landmark thing, but that's the first one that we've really seen. I mean, I just was thinking back on, first really getting heavily involved within DoD on AI, and this is, 8 years ago. I mean, that's not that long. I mean, that's that long time. I joke with my wife, I've been doing that. I was involved more, but we met at the same, it's probably about the course of our relationship. That we've that I've been really that heavily doing this stuff, it is early days. We are still have quite a ways to go, and LLMs and ChatGPT have just introduced a whole new flavor to this world that we I don't think we quite know, understand. We definitely don't understand the risk, I think it scares people. I think it scares a lot of folks. About what it means for them in terms of jobs and things like that. But I think that it actually can be quite promising. I really do. I think that if we take the idea of data as an imperative, almost like treating it like a public good, and take training data that way, in a way that is representative of our values and representative of kind of our approach to our approach to democracy. I don't know. I don't want to sound
Critical
too over
infrastructure.
the top. Over the top. Yeah, I don't want to sound too over the top, but I
No,
would say that
I think
we
maybe
have to we have
personally.
to imbue values into the data. But when we look to near peer competitors, which is going to be no surprise, like China or Russia, they don't have any problem with training data. I mean, they collect it. It's a massive amounts of data. We have to think about how we make training data the same thing. That's the only thing that makes my heart sink when sometimes I see legislation that talks about models and everything like that. And I love models, but I got to say, like, what's going to power those things? Like, let's think about that. Let's start with the fundamentals. This is building blocks and bridges, and this is 1930s again. It's just that they're made out of data.
Yeah, I mean, I think first, yeah, I've been doing some work in and around CISA recently, and when I start thinking about, critical infrastructure, I think that like that's definitely should be considered part of it, right? It's not like physical infrastructure, but it's critical to a lot of the higher level and higher order, ML models and AI deployments that we want to talk about. It's to all of them, I should say. And those are going to continue to be more and more important to us, our national security, right? For all kinds of reasons. But yeah, I think that it absolutely is critical infrastructure. I also think that, of course people are not talking about it, man. Everybody wants to talk about the pretty thing on top, right? It's like everybody talking about, oh my God, this guy was a success overnight. It's like, what you didn't see is the 10 years that they before they even popped out, right? The 10 years that they spent learning and working and putting persistence in, right? Nobody wants to talk about that. Everybody wants to talk about the pretty outputs and the models and the this and the that. But at the end of the day, none of those function without the underlying trading data.
And
And
100%
that's
true. Yeah, and that's I mean, I think we definitely get over our skis, for lack of a better term, quite a bit. And I think in particular when it comes to like all these, the LLMs are going to solve everything, and I love them. I think they're fantastic, but they're not going to solve everything. I think the other things are, they're going to solve everything, or we're, now we've got these wonderful models, and I'm like, that's not, we need to put these foundations into place. And this is where, again, when I got started with the training data project and the work that I do now, in the, defense and intelligence space, I am all about like, let's build really solid foundations. Let's de-risk ourselves. I mean, I think, let's make sure that we put in good standards for like quantifiable quality, so we don't end up with these unquantifiable risks. We don't even know what's in the data. And we can't train models off of it because data errors are incredibly expensive to fix. They're usually more expensive than the models, than the infrastructure on which it runs. I can't tell you the number of times where I've had people say, like, I got this great data set, but we did this and this and this. And they're like, well, and it's not working. So what do I do? And I was like, start over, start over. And they're like, really? Yeah. Yeah. They're like, I can fix it. I was like, no, you can't. I was like, you're just gonna start over. That's gonna be your best avenue. And but it is critical infrastructure in a way that if we truly took it as seriously, I think, as we need to, it could dramatically change the ways in which we are approaching AI. And I think it would really accelerate our ability to do things, because that's what the private sector really craves more than anything. If you asked, I think private sector companies, mostly what they would want is to sit down with a customer and understand what they're trying to do. And if they could give them representative data, oh my gosh. I understand you can't always do that in the classified space, but if you give them even representative unclassified data, that's going to make a world of difference. And there are good initiatives out there that do that right now.
Yeah, man. No, and it's always more expensive to fix it afterwards, than to
Oh
do
gosh.
it. And this is
Yeah.
not, I mean, it's a little different example, but like when I first started my first company, which was a little over 8 years ago now, it's funny how that keeps to that time frame. But a little over 8 years ago, right, I was set up in an office of a friend of mine who him and his wife were, well, at the time they were girlfriend, his girl is now wife was going through a divorce, and like her personal expenses and business expenses had been mixed up in her books, right? And so she had to go back through for 10 years and recategorize everything. And like just sitting and watching the pain that they were going through as it related to that was just like, I'm never, ever, ever doing that ever, because just, you're right, just start over, right? Let's just get fresh books. You can sync your QuickBooks from the start of the account, whatever, and just keep it moving as opposed to trying to replace it, because now the amount of tedium involved with all that is crazy. And yeah, it's it,
And
it
I just, yeah, I think that I would say, I think if we can do some of those things as more public initiatives, it would so speed along the other problems that we're all familiar with in the government space. Like, how do we get through acquisition wickets faster? How do we get things, a bit able to work on government networks? Even if we, we're always looking for, things to do. It's, again, that's why I say this is a nonprofit. I'm not, it's not, selling something. It's truly just like, I want to see government be able to succeed at this and do it as fast as we can, and do it at impact and speed and scale in a way that we need to be able to do. And and somebody's got to, I feel like, got to stand up and have that voice, because you do read about, Wall Street Journal has a great AI section. So there is a shameless plug. I love the Journal. I love the Post too, but I read Post, the New York Times, and the Journal. But they did this really wonderful article on data scarcity, that leads to model collapse with LLMs, because we're just running out of data. And I think that this is the time for us to really, take, not take a pause, but like, let's just recalibrate and say, like, how are we going to create human-based data, that is representative of us and imbues in the data that we want, in order to really train these models to stretch in a way that's, going to allow them to be, so much better performant than they are right now.
Yeah. No, man, I love it. I love it, Dave. I love what you're doing, man. How can people support you?
So, that's a great question. So, right now we, you can come to our website, brainanddataproject.org. You can follow us on LinkedIn. We have a newsletter. We are, I am, with a colleague of mine, Tim, we are writing a book. I think we're, I don't think that's going to actually allow us. It's going to be an ebook, but I don't think it allows us to do it for, to give it away for free. So, anything that we would make, it'd probably be like a buck, but anything we make off of it, we'd be donating to causes out there to help people who are neurodiverse or veterans, or people who have, are differently abled or have challenges. To kind of support those organizations. I think that's really important. Or people who are, the other group that we really work with is people in recovery and are trying to kind of get their lives together after incarceration. But you can come to our website, and we've got a couple of avenues to help support us. You can certainly give, and we appreciate the support. I think the most important thing is just, we're trying to raise awareness. We've got a lot of content out there, and feel free to reach out to me. You can, there's an info at trainingdataproject.org that goes to me and to my wife, and we read every email. I've been amazed at the community that we've been able to build, and go support other folks too. I have colleagues out there like the Human Feedback Foundation, a few different organizations that are really doing, I think, great work out there in AI ML, and some of my favorite companies are doing phenomenal stuff. So,
Absolutely, man. I really appreciate you coming on Robots at Red Tape Day. This has been a lot of fun, man. And I appreciate
I
you taking
love talking about this. This has been so much fun for me.
I can talk about this for a long time, man, if you can't tell. I really enjoy it. I enjoyed our conversation. And really, anything else you wanna add before we wrap up the episode, man?
Yeah, I what I'll say, because I think a lot of folks are probably wondering, like, what the future of AI is gonna bring from a vantage point of, in areas like I work, like in defense and intelligence, I really want to encourage people. I know sometimes AI really scares some folks, and I just want to encourage people to think about, that the voices that the things that I'm talking about here, I can assure you that these are things that we're all talking about in this community, and we're really trying to think of, good ways to do it right. AI is not something to be afraid of. I always like to say it's letting machines do what machines do well, and humans do what only humans can do. And so, the promise of human machine teaming is vast. It really is. And I think, the great thing about working in things like data is it does allow us to really kind of come up with this, to be very clear about what truth is, because that's what we want AI to represent. We don't want it to be skewed in any direction. We really want to be able to, have ground truth, and to be able to create AI that's really going to help us. So the future is incredibly bright. It just has to start with us taking data really seriously.
Absolutely. Well, man, I really appreciate it, Dave. Thank you again, and thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape, everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.